Hi, and welcome to the Planet Podcast, a technology, science, and internet culture podcast based out of Baltimore, Maryland. I'm your host, Patrick Roanhouse, and today I have the pleasure of having a very special guest today for the guest interview sessions of the Planet Podcast, Mr. Jay Adelson, CEO of Digg.com. How are you doing today, Jay?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on the show, man. It's a real pleasure to have you on.
Well, it's great. You know, it's a... As far as I'm concerned, it's great to finally be on a podcast again. It's like, you know, it's near and dear to my heart, as you know, mm-hmm. Revision 3, mm-hmm. To be sort of back on broadcast.
Mm-hmm. Now, just for people in my audience who don't know, why don't you tell what Digg.com is first?
Digg.com is the place where people go to discover, share news and media. It's driven by crowd wisdom, meaning that you go and you dig or vote on stories that you think are relevant to the rest of the world, and we aggregate that information and expose it on our front page. And when a story gets to our front page, it will get millions of additional visitors than what would normally happen. Something called the dig effect. So we're excited and we get some pretty serious usage. We're at about 40 million users worldwide and about 20,000 submissions into the system every day. And you'll see our little dig buttons all over the internet next to content that people can submit.
Mm-hmm. So you were born in the lovely time of 1970.
That's right.
Can you tell us, like, what was life growing up for you like? What were some of your hobbies? Like, what did Jay do? Was he a precocious little scamp, or was he, you know, very, you know, book nebbish and having glasses that he'd press up with a little tape between them?
That would be probably closer to accurate, actually. I was born in Detroit and lived in Detroit in the suburbs in Southfield. Mm-hmm. And I was blind as a bat. I think I was 3 years old. My mother asked me what I was watching on TV, and I said green. So she figured out pretty quick that I couldn't see. And I remember, I was 3 years old still, I remember getting these glasses that were like Coke bottle glasses, just thick and just begging to be beaten up on a constant basis. Mm-hmm. But I also, you know, I think there were a few things that were really important to me, even as a little kid, growing up that remained true. And as if you try to imagine the nerdy little kid I was, this is pre-internet days. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, technology, video games, radio and music, broadcast, the idea of using technology to sort of reach out to a larger group and somehow be social. These were things that a kid like me was really into. Mm-hmm. My hobbies were filmmaking. I think I won the Michigan Student Film Festival. I was 9 years old when I won that prize, and was really into that. I built a radio station in my high school. You know, was really into broadcast and all of this. And but the real life-changing event for me was getting an Apple II when I was 11 years old, which that combined with an Apple Cat II modem just changed my entire planet. It's sort of, you know, you think of getting a car when you're 16 sort of opens up your world. To me, my life-changing moment was getting that computer.
And we must all thank Mr. John Draper, Captain Crunch, for that modem.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, of course. John Draper. You know, it's funny. I worshipped that guy when I was a kid. You know, I remember going to the library. This just shows you how old I am. And looking up on microfiche, the articles that were written about Captain Crunch originally. And mm-hmm. and all of the various freakers with a PH mm-hmm. who would you know, hack the telecom system. Because pre-internet, that was the coolest thing you could hack. And I built the boxes. I built blue boxes and red boxes and cheese boxes and all sorts of interesting devices. I had a lot of fun with that stuff. And of course, I had no idea anything I was doing could possibly be in any way illegal.
You were under 18, so remember, you were perfectly fine. Just as soon as you hit 18, start deleting everything you have that's illegal.
Well, you know, it's funny. It probably was less about whether it was legal or illegal. It's more about what my parents would have thought. And then, of course, the most important thing, what the telecom, what you know, the phone company would think. Mm-hmm. And where I grew up in Southfield, Michigan, it was a testing center for new technologies on the phone system. I remember AT&T tested, I think, their first 5E, if not in Southfield. Certainly, Southfield was one of the first. And all of a sudden, the phone number that originated a lot of these things would appear on people's bills. That was not a fun moment for me.
Nice.
I did pay all that back. I just want to, just for the record, my dad, my mom, they were, when they learned that I was having fun dialing all over the internet using various technologies, they made me pay. Mm-hmm. It was a good first experience.
So talking about your parents, because they're the most influential people in our lives usually, what did your parents do?
Well, you know, about the time I was born, they were still teaching school in the Detroit public system. I think my mom subbed a lot. My dad taught chemistry and math and probably was more of like the phys ed teacher kind of guy. Try to imagine me. I'm tall, skinny guy with glasses. My dad definitely was more of a jock type football player kind of guy. But then by the time I was really more sentient and I was in, you know, going into middle school and high school, my parents worked in the family business, which was an electric supply business in Detroit, Center Electric Supply Company. And this was basically the place you'd go if you were building someplace and you needed wire or you needed, you know, junction boxes or you needed a chandelier. This was the place in Detroit to go do that. And they made that work. I used to work there either as a janitor or, you know, as a stock boy for my childhood. And, you know, it was definitely a educational experience for me because I watched my father really go from being a salesperson there to taking over the business completely and becoming, the boss, the president, the CEO, and building that family business to a profitable one. My mother, decided sometime around when I was in high school to get a master's in family counseling, which, by the way, I highly recommend any parents out there. It's very useful to have a mother who's a family counselor because of all of our dysfunctions as a family, like every family, it was great having her focus on that. I think the influence of the parents never really stopped in watching them through their lives and sort of their hobbies and their interests in music, in film, in books. But really, the most incredible thing they ever did for me was never put restrictions on me in terms of how nerdy I could become. And how intense I can get into it. And not just about computers and online, but also about the film and radio world that I was really attracted to.
So they were very strong in fostering your passions and hobbies then growing up.
Absolutely. It was a very strange moment. I remember the day I told them, I had applied to college, a number of colleges, for different things. I remember applying to some of the schools for computer science and some for film and broadcasting. And in the end, I decided to go to Boston University for film. And I was so terrified that they would be disappointed with this, which is a very difficult thing to get to get any kind of vocation guarantee. And they were very supportive. And said, okay, well, somehow we think Jay is going to make this into a career somehow, some way. In worst case scenario, his computer skills will save him if the film skills don't work out.
Yeah, because on the Wikipedia, it does say you graduated from Boston University with dual degrees in computer science and film broadcasting.
That is wrong.
That is wrong? Okay.
Yeah, in fact, Wikipedia, you know, if anybody wants to go out there and edit my Wikipedia page and fix it, they're welcome to, because I'm terrified to even touch it. God forbid. Mm-hmm. I graduated with a degree in film and broadcasting, and I had something called a concentration in computer science, which is basically at Boston University at the time. I mean, they probably have dual degrees now with, you know, computer graphics and animation and who knows what else. But back then, they were very distinct. And so they would let me take as many courses as I want, even graduate courses in computer science. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I was in the school of communications. And so
it was like basically you did like a minor or a side program that like a lot of UC schools do nowadays that require.
Right. I did as much as they would let me do. And yet I managed to escape taking discrete math, which I couldn't stand. it was great. I was really into, so besides the film part, which I was more into sound engineering and post-production were my favorite parts of that. I pursued, artificial intelligence, data communications, big surprise, you know, and anything that could possibly touch online. And remember, this is prior to consumer internet and prior to the World Wide Web. So, you know,
so like 1990s, still when you're dialing up with analog couplers kind of time?
Well, the analog couplers were gone probably by, you know, the mid-80s, at least for me. I was plugging directly in. I remember I would have the latest and greatest, you know, modem in terms of its standard of support. Mm-hmm. I would know a year in advance before that modem technology would come out with, you know, I remember when 2400 came out, when 9600 came out, when, you know, there would be some proprietary 14.4 and then later, you know, 56K, all that stuff I was really into. But you can really get a sense of how much I was online and how early, because all those Usenet posts still exist. You know, the really embarrassing ones, like, is it true a Highlander movie, a second one's coming out? Or, you know, more specific nerd stuff like, hey, I've got my Apple IIgs here or my Amiga 2000, and I'm really trying to figure out how to do this very obscure thing. Can someone out there on the internet help me? And I would get help through the Usenet.
So looking at Wikipedia, it also says you were a graduate of a private school education. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's fair. I think my parents, having some experience in the Detroit public school system, decided that anything but would be good for me at the time. Now, remember, this is the 70s. Mm. And, you know, this isn't really speaking about the Detroit system today. You know, back then, my parents had a lot of trouble with me in school, in public school, right up until third grade. My second grade teacher, if he's out there, his name was Mr. Turbo, literally thought I was mentally ill. He thought I was developmentally disabled, that there was something significantly wrong with me because of the trouble I would cause in class. I was a class comedian. I wouldn't do my work. And I was trouble. And he just assumed that I was slow. And then my third grade teacher, again in Southfield Public School, her name was Jewel Anderson, was basically my savior. What she recognized that I had, you know, I was just bored to tears. I was horribly bored. Probably, you know, now would have been diagnosed with attention deficit. Who knows? But I was just horribly bored. So she tested the hell out of me. And shared it with my parents, who, again, my parents were pretty sophisticated. They understood the stuff, and they were like, okay, can we afford to basically use 3/4 of our income to get Jay into this private school called Cranbrook, which is in Bloomfield Hills, Michigan, which is a real art. It was funny because it definitely was a Dead Poets Society kind of atmosphere, a beautiful campus and bricks and ivy and the whole nine yards, but a day student. And you would be in the same campus with artists and graduate students going to college there for art. And they had a science institution, all this sort of adult ed. Mm-hmm. at the same time you're a kid in this beautiful environment. So it was a very artsy school, very left, no question about that. Mm-hmm. And a lot of scholarship kids. So there was a very diverse group. It wasn't all like rich kids, but definitely the atmosphere, very sheltering, very mm-hmm. beautiful.
Yes. Yeah. So between graduating from Boston University and founding Equinix, which we'll talk about after this, what did you do with your life?
Between
Boston University and the founding of Equinix.
Oh, there's a whole drama. Well, I mean, when I graduate, so back to that Usenet I was mm-hmm. talking about, you know, I started pen-palling with a guy named Paul Theodoropoulos. I'm going to drop names every now and then because who knows, he might be listening. Mm-hmm. He was working at Skywalker Sound at LucasArts. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I begged him to help me find a way in there and like intern for Lucas. And when I had an opportunity and there was even a glimmer of hope, I moved out west immediately after BU to San Rafael, California, and started doing like a weekend thing here, interning with them or at Saul Zantz Film Center, doing film work, you know, doing MagnaSync transfers for those old school film guys. They'll know what I'm talking about. You know, Lynx boxes and adjusting the azimuth of this and that. Meanwhile, though, going horribly broke because the apartment that they helped me find was way beyond my income, way mm-hmm. beyond. So what do you do in 1992 if you're broke, living in California, and you can't get enough film work to pay your rent? And you're an internet guy, and, you know, someone who uses shell accounts, you really know your tech. I knew my Macs and my Amigas. I went to a company called MacTemps, which was a temp agency that would test you on like Excel and Word and PageMaker and I forgot all the apps, and would send you to basically any business that needed a computer person. That could be a writer. It could be a, you know, this is even pre-Ethernet, okay? So, so you know, anything tech, you know, you would get these jobs and they would pay you $20 an hour. So I was basically paying my way going into these businesses, being their internet guy. And they would then offer me a job almost every time. They're like, please, 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 you know your shit, pardon my French, stay here.
We have the explicit tag, so you can curse all you want, sir.
There you go. And they're like, stay here. You know, we'll pay you $20K to stay here. And I'd be like, oh, that's like twice what I'm making in film. And it finally got to this point where I just wasn't able to get anything permanent. And the way that my parents had raised me, they, you know, I valued financial security, and I was getting none in any of this. And eventually I'd end up accepting one of these boring jobs. And that was very terrifying for me. It was like giving up on my passion. So I did what a lot of silly kids do when they hit these moments of indecision. And I took all of my credit cards and I bought a bunch of traveler's checks. And I bought one of those $2,000 plane tickets where you can fly around the world for as long as you want, as many stops as you want, as long as you only cross the hemisphere twice, I think it was. And I left for 9 months, at which point I remember thinking to myself, oh, I'm going to climb the mountain and figure it out. I literally did climb the mountain. I went to Nepal. I went to the Khumbu region there mm-hmm. and, you know, Kalapatar and all this and, you know, just seeing Everest and all this. And I remember thinking, okay, I've got it now. What I'm going to do is I'm going to be a teacher. I want to be a teacher. I love teaching. I love communicating. And I know all this stuff about tech. Maybe I'll be a teacher. I'd love to teach kids. And I come back after this trip to Detroit. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, I'm going to go get certified. I'm ready to go. I've decided what I'm going to do with my life. And I get a phone call from my friend, Jeff Rizzo, who now is the CTO of Revision 3, by the way. Mm-hmm. And he says to me, hey, we'll offer you $30K to come work at NetComm, this startup that I'm starting, which was the first commercial internet service provider in the United States. So before that, you had AOL, which would be like a walled garden, not the internet. You had like CompuServe and The Source.
And back when you had to have a number for your blah, blah, blah at AOL.com, you know.
That's right.
And it couldn't be, there could be no eights in it because they didn't have the octets in there. Because
that world had existed for 15 years previously, right? So now there was these college graduates like me who were used to using email through your college. And then when they became, they left school, they were no longer allowed to use these systems. You know, that was only for research. It was only for if you worked for the universities, and businesses didn't have internet yet. I mean, we're talking about the very beginning of the commercialization of the internet, 1993. And, he said, hey, help me start this. A guy named Bob Rieger, who's the CEO and founder of NetComm. This is late 93, early 94. And he says, come on over. And I'm like, 30K? You're kidding. So much for being a teacher. Came back to the Bay Area, started work with him, building this first internet service provider that then, when Mosaic became popular, wrote the first commercial browser called NetCruiser before Netscape was even released. There was NetCruiser with built-in web and Usenet and email. Little known fact, NetCruiser was first. And it was crazy. It was the frontier of the internet. And here I was, this film graduate with this computer science knowledge, building and operating the, first national network. I remember one night, it was like midnight, being on the phone with technicians at what would later be WorldCom. At the time, it was called Wiltel. And hearing, turning up the first DS3. Commercial DS3 and the technicians on the phone saying, I've never seen a blue alarm before. It's like they didn't even know about what this technology meant and how to use it. It was all the frontier. And I did that right up until late 96. I left NetComm to work at Digital Equipment Corporation at DEC in their research and development group in Palo Alto, because I could spend a day on this, but the core of a lot of internet activity was happening at Digital at the time in Palo Alto. A guy named Paul Vixie, another guy named Stephen Stewart. These guys were working in the network systems laboratory for Brian Reed. And they were doing things like they had the core Usenet hub called Gatekeeper. And they were doing the first internet peering stuff. That's a whole other day of discussion. And this guy, Al Avery, who had been a marketing guy and a product guy at Digital Equipment, found me because of my unique experience with dealing with building NetComm, and said, you know what, we need you to come help us build the operations around this idea we have about neutral internet exchange. And the idea was important because in 1994, the internet had changed from this research world to one where the government and the networks that made up the internet would change to be this, for pay, and the telecoms would take over. Originally, the National Science Foundation funded the internet with this central backbone, and it converted to this distributed network where like Sprint and AT&T and all the guys, WorldCom, everyone, and Pac Bell, they would all start to operate their own networks independent of one another and then connect to each other via these hubs around the United States. Wasn't as international yet. And there was some major, I guess, political and economic challenges and security challenges and availability challenges and uptime challenges that no one had really thought through. And at Digital, they were thinking about these things. And now Avery was thinking about these things. And Paul and Steven and Al had come up with this idea to create a neutral internet exchange where we would create in the lab a place and say, look, we're not a telephone company. We're not an ISP like Netcom. We're not a telephone company like AT&T. We're not going to compete with you. We're going to be this neutral playing field like an airport is to airlines. And we're going to invite you all in to connect to each other, to create the inter part of the internet and learn how to do it, learn how to scale it. Because the internet, it was Bob Metcalf, I think, had predicted the crash of the internet by 96. People were worried because these telecom operated exchange points were congested and breaking. And so we tried it. And it was crazy successful. I'm skipping ahead a couple of years, but I ended up leaving Digital with Al to found Equinix.
Hmm. Now, this is when you found Equinix, it was the height of the dot-com era. You know, it was right at 98. I like to say that the exact height of the internet was when The Matrix came out because, you know, that you when you really judge it, it's when everyone's mind share was all about the internet and how things are connected, if you think about it. But when it came to doing that data center that was providing the co-location and the traffic exchange and the peering, what were some of your thoughts? Because it was this, like, did you feel that, you know, you're worried that this might come to an end? You know, like, I mean, Equinix went public in 2000. And, like, what were your fears when you were doing this? Like, were there any particular, you know, Cassandra moments that you're having?
That's so funny. I would say there's many. The passion, you have to understand, if you put yourself in my head in 1998, the challenge was we had this internet that everybody was using and taking for granted, but it could go down. It could go down any moment, and it did. I mean, people forget how unstable the internet was in 1998. I'm not talking about busy signals. I'm talking about your e-commerce. You know, the first portals are hitting the scene, like Yahoo, and it's a different world. And Al and I had this experiment going on, right, and it, which is part of this company with 120,000 employees. It's hardly the same feeling as starting a .com. And when we quit to start Equinix, if you had asked us why we were doing it, and, you know, this probably doesn't sound too believable, but the reality is we felt we had to. And that if we didn't do it, the internet would not scale. If you read articles about Equinix back in 98, 2000, even through 2002, it's these weird statements that I'm making and Al's making. It's like, no, you don't understand. We have no choice. This has to happen. If we don't do this, the internet won't scale. The inter part of the internet will become congested. The economics of the internet will be too expensive for the end user to ever have fast speed internet. We needed to create a level playing field and disintermediate the market so that the little ISP could compete with the big ISP and we wouldn't create the telecom monopoly problems that had existed in the 80s with the internet, and also to keep it unregulated. So we felt this weird sort of almost religious fervor about needing to make this happen. And then they figured out, you know, we were sitting down and we planned on a spreadsheet what it would take to do it. And we realized we'd have to raise $1 billion in cash. And I'm not exaggerating. And we're like, oh, okay, well, whatever. So we'll raise $1 billion. So we did. And we brought this company to profitability because it was required for the internet to grow. I don't care if there's a dot-com crash. I don't care if there's a telecom collapse where they're all going bankrupt and going to jail. The reality is the internet was not going to stop. That was a snowball rolling down the hill. So if there was one business that was guaranteed to continue operating through all of the mess, it was Equinix. Remember, not just a data center company. More importantly, they were an exchange services company.
It was the peering and also the neutrality of it, the fact that anyone could come to it and be like, you are the the UN of the internet, essentially.
Exactly. Exactly. And it was a commercial company. It was a publicly traded company. But it had this credibility of being neutral and making its money based on, you know, simple real estate and never taxing the user. So never sticking your hand out and collecting a tax on the traffic that passes through. I remember when the storage explosion happened in 99 and 2000, there were companies who were telling me they were selling storage over our cross connects and our centers that were making millions of dollars a day, you know, in the storage of content and managed services. And we were charging $200 a month for those services that they were using. But we didn't compromise. We knew that the value of the real estate would increase and that if we built the best data centers ever built, banks and e-commerce and network nodes and everybody would feel comfortable in these sort of mission impossible.
Oh, hello? Oh, I think you're you just broke up. I'm gonna hang up and recall you again, okay? Hello?
Okay. Sure.
Okay, so sorry podcast listeners, that was in the middle of the interview. Had a little problem with the wireless. It went down. So
there you go.
Yes, the internet went down. Oh dear.
It happens.
I know. So you were talking about Equinix. I believe the last thing you were talking about were particularly, what were you saying?
Well, I think we were talking a little bit about expectations of, I was about to get into really my mindset at the time. Yes. And, you know, that we went and raised $1 billion and we executed on this business that was really critical and survived through the dot-com crash. And it did, and it is surviving. And Equinix now is, I don't know, like a $3 to $4 billion market cap business that is doing quite well. That all being said, one very piece of that $3 or $4 billion market cap, and that somehow it made me really wealthy. Being the founder of a company does not necessarily mean that you're going to have a piece of it when it becomes valuable. And the dot-com crash, independent of business, unfortunately also caused me to go through some massive dilution. And when the internet bubble burst, I went through something called a 32-for-1 reverse split, which me and Al both suffered. Don't get me wrong. We always were very, very proud of what we accomplished, but you know, it's a little different than the guy who builds a business and sells it for millions. It was a labor of love.
So, talking about labor of love, because of the fact that you became so influential with the business that you'd started with Equinix in 2003, you testified before the United States House of Homeland Security Homeland Security subcommittees on emerging threats on cybersecurity and science and technology. They'll say that all properly again. United States House of Homeland Security Subcommittee on Emerging Threats, Cybersecurity, and Science and Technology. Particularly in your panel role was the private sector's role in keeping American cyberspace secure. How was it? I mean, the normal person going in front of, you know, a large committee that's a very, you know, it's the government. How was that? How were you feeling when you were up on, you know, giving your talk about it?
Well, I guess to set a little background. So you asked about testifying before Congress, and I will tell you a little bit of context there. So when 9/11 happened, Equinix was a little bit in the middle of a lot of activity as it relates to internet security. Not only did massive amounts of data get destroyed in that event, and Equinix really was the sort of an obvious player in restoring a lot of connectivity and security, but also internet and cybersecurity became something that the Bush administration, and really actually before the Bush administration, the Clinton administration also was very focused on how could we secure the cyberspace, is what they wanted to call it, which is, you know, funny to me. And they had involved me, and by they I mean agencies, Congress, and the various working groups that had existed to advise a bit on how the internet actually worked and where the dangers to the internet might emerge, and you know what the potential ramifications of an attack on the internet, you know, just looking at the whole system was something that obviously from the perspective that we were sitting in at the airports of the internet, we had some interesting visibility to. So you know, there was a number of initiatives that we took part of. At one point, during the formation of the Department of Homeland Security, they decided to create a oversight for the development of the cybersecurity elements of that. And I was brought in to testify on what the private sector and basically the relationship between the private sector and the public sector in this regard. And why it was a real big deal at the time is, remember, the internet is an unregulated medium. In fact, the network neutrality debate that exists today is largely related to this. One of the reasons why the internet has done so well is because it's been left open and there hasn't been any kind of regulatory restrictions, and it's been a level playing field for competition. Remember, Equinix was built on this idea of it being a level playing field and a little guy being able to compete with the big guy. So nobody wants regulation of the internet that restricts that. And it's important to point out what regulation means, because there's a lot of misinformation out there. You know, the term regulation could mean regulating the internet to ensure neutrality. That would be a good regulation, right?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then there's the other form of regulation, which is I'm actually going to do the opposite. I'm going to maybe charge you or somehow tax you or control the nature of the services that you put over the internet. It really can be used in both directions, that term. And so at the time, there was some question. It's like, okay, well, if we're going to be protecting the internet from internet terrorists or cyber, you know, terrorists, would the government step in and monitor all traffic going across the internet? And there, you know, needless to say, there are ways to do that. They're very cumbersome, and we, the private sector, did not think that was a good idea. For all of the reasons that I'm sure your audience can agree with, that would be a very horrible idea. And so I became kind of vocal about being constructive here. I thought the government did have a role in cybersecurity, and I think that the place that the government could sit is in a neutral position, sort of like Equinix did for our role, where the government could be the information repository for troubleshooting, localizing, and protecting yourself against cyber attack. Not monitoring the internet at all, but providing the communications infrastructure for dealing with outages and problems on the internet in real time. And the reason why that would be useful is, you can imagine if I've got competitors, if I'm a network service provider and my competitors are all trying to win business, we might not have the best pre-existing communications plan between us. You know, relying on the private sector to set that up, while it actually does exist, there's organizations like NANOG, the North American Network Operators Group, there's a lot of different things that exist. Relying on the private sector alone to create that communication infrastructure might be a bad idea. And so if you read my testimony that day, it's largely defined, you know, trying to be constructive and saying, look, forget monitoring the internet. The right thing to do here is to provide the information sharing infrastructure.
All right.
And I hope it's not too heady, but
No, actually, I have a background in IT infrastructure. Being in the DC area, I'm well versed with the rigor and rots of the precarious nature of setting up internet security for companies. And it is one of the, I think, a very important thing from my standpoint to talk about, especially someone like yourself who has such a background in it.
Well, it doesn't matter how much of a background I have in it. When you go into Congress and you're sitting in front of the entire subcommittee, and by the way, everyone showed up that day. I mean, there's nothing more intimidating than sitting in front of a congressional subcommittee. And they were very nice, and their staffers were very nice. C-SPAN was not in the room because it's a little boring topic, I think, at the time. Now with network neutrality, it would probably be front and center. But yeah, it was scary. There was a lot going on that summer, and this was probably one of the pivotal moments that led to me moving from California to New York with my family to try to get out of entrepreneurship and go back to school teaching, which, as you can tell, really succeeded.
So, bringing back to getting back into entrepreneurship, the person who dragged you back, I would have to say that most people would think would be Mr. Kevin Rose.
That is an accurate statement. Yes, Kevin did drag me back into entrepreneurship.
So how did you guys first cross paths? And from that time, how long did it take for Dig to come about?
Well, I was a tech TV fan from its origins as ZDTV. I used to watch Jim Louderback on Fresh Gear, and I used to watch Leo Laporte on the Screensavers, and I just loved it. As you guys could tell, any of the listeners from hearing the story so far, if there's a king of the nerds, I'm pretty close because I'm as nerdy as they get. And I loved that show so much. I actually had Dish Network in San Francisco when it was just starting, just so I could get ZDTV and Tech TV. And so I was always watching that. And in my job as the founder and chief technology officer of Equinix, I was in front of the press a lot. I was on TV. I was being interviewed by newspapers, but I never got to be on Tech TV. Right? And that pissed me off. Like, you know, it's like, here's the convergence. And so, you know, when I remember a competitor of ours called Exodus, which was a big hosting company, went bankrupt. They brought me on Tech TV finally to be interviewed on their news show. And it was like a 10-second piece. And I was just so sad that I only got to see it for 10 seconds. I'm like, here it is, film and broadcasting about technology. It was the perfect convergence of what I would be interested in, and I couldn't stay. So years go by, and I think it's mid-03, I want to say. It's kind of fuzzy in my memory, but Kevin Rose at this point is a host of the Screensavers.
When it moved down to G4, correct?
This is before then. This is okay. Still in San Francisco. Comcast hasn't purchased Tech TV yet. And
Back when he was the Dark Tipper and stuff like
that's
that.
That's right, the Dark Tipper. And I, you know, I'll reveal a little truth here. At that point, I had become so busy with everything going on, as you could hear, things like congressional testimonies. I didn't actually watch much Tech TV. And I had known who Kevin Rose was by name, but I actually hadn't seen him on the show yet. But I had heard that our press group had been contacted by a producer at Tech TV, interested in doing a segment on the Screensavers to show the public what the internet physically looks like. We all talk about the internet as this virtual thing, but is there a way to physically show you? And of course, if you take a camera into the actual hub of all internet traffic on the West Coast, you know, it might be as close as you can get to that. And this fascinated Kevin. And he brought a film crew to our San Jose center at the time. And we met at that point. And it was a really funny moment because here I am, a film and broadcasting guy who was working in computer and IT and entrepreneurship, right? He had gone to school for computer and IT and was working as a film and broadcasting guy. And we met at that moment, and I remember just thinking to myself, he's got an amazing job. I want his job. And I suspect, you know, and this is a great question for Kevin, but I think, you know, we've talked about it in the past. He sort of hinted that he always wanted to be an entrepreneur at the time and had been thinking about that too. And so I think at that moment when he did that segment, there was a little bit of a bromance that began. And I remember at the time after the segment was done, he was talking to me about a video he had produced that just for fun with his friend Dan Heward called The Broken. That was really just done as like a weekend project. It wasn't really a business. It was just for fun. He was having fun. He was really into hacking. It was really funny because he would talk about hacking in these terms. You know, I felt like I had been there at NetComm. We had been involved in the apprehension of Kevin Mitnick, right? I was sitting in the room when we caught him, you know. So on one hand, hacking was a love of mine. On the other hand, it was this...
The bane of your existence.
Bane of my existence. And he had this sort of comic book view of the whole thing, the Dark Tipper. And so we needed to have, like, you know, some kind of reconciliation there. But The Broken was interesting. And he told me he hosted it on this random server somewhere. It was Mac. It was the .Mac hosting. And he said it was so popular, it had so many millions of downloads that it took down .Mac. And I was like, oh yeah, right. You know. So I called up my buddy who did network engineering at Apple, and I said, is this true? And he goes, it's absolutely true. It totally did. And I was like, okay, there's something going on here, you know, with this Kevin Rose character. So we started getting together and meeting about, you know, business ideas and video ideas and different concepts. And he started really shopping the idea of Dig to me, I would say in 04, in early 04. And it had various different forms. And my value to the conversation was he would give me all these great product and feature ideas. And I would tell him if it was an actual business and how it could be a business and how you would raise money and how you might do these things. But mid-04, I moved to New York, and mid-04, he moved to LA because Comcast bought Tech TV. And so it became more of a phone-based conversation. He was terribly bored with being a television host. And he would call me during the commercial breaks, and he would say, check this out. I'm going to do some hand signals to you as soon as the cameras turn back on. And they would come back on, and he'd be standing on camera, he'd do these hand signals. I'm like, you know, man, he is really bored.
So it's like, hey, Jay, what's up, man? Yeah, just in the middle of the show.
It was so funny. And so we just, you know, we kept tweaking the ideas. And it got to a point where I think Dig was really worthy of getting prototyped. And again, you know, I wasn't the one prototyping it and founding the idea. This all came from Kevin, but I really encouraged him. I think others encouraged him as well to go prototype Dig right about the same time that we were planning the business model for Revision 3. And both of those business models were really done over the phone. And Dig, because it actually had a website associated with it, really was the first to be seen by the public there in December of 2004, 5 years ago, almost to a week ago.
What's your, it's kind of funny because before Dig, there was Slashdot, and you had the Slashdot effect of, you know, where if they had an article on there, your servers would be down. And Dig is kind of like, in a way, replaced what Slashdot used to be.
There definitely was a time when I think that was more the case, and there was Slashdot users who came to Dig and Dig users who, and there was some kind of, I don't know, almost competitive feeling between us and Slashdot. And the truth is we were all big Slashdot users. We loved the editorial that was going on there. They would receive hundreds of submitted articles a day, and a group of really smart people would decide what was cool and what wasn't, which, by the way, I'm still very jealous of sometimes, you know? So, you know, I mean, I think Digg's idea was, well, what if we let the users decide what should or shouldn't be shown? And by the way, it didn't work at first. I mean, there was a lot of things we had to tweak, patents we had to develop, technologies we had to invent before it really worked. But, you know, early on, because it was tech-focused, there was that overlap with Slashdot. But, you know, once we opened up the site to multiple topics, really that feeling of competition went away. And I think, by the way, that's one of the things that Digg is really needing to recapture. Is
competition?
Well, I mean, we definitely want to not so much to compete, but to create micro communities that are as strong as they were, as our tech community was when we started. We're redeveloping Digg right now so that, you know, a more of a Digg slash, like Digg 2005 Slashdot 2005 type of flavor of community could exist and have their own homepage, their own experience that isn't compromised by the fact that Digg is becoming so mainstream that, you know, a Britney Spears article might be popular too. And those two worlds can coexist now in the new version of Digg coming.
So kind of like creating what Reddit's done where you can subscribe to certain feeds in your news ticker.
You know, certainly I think that's one way of handling it. The way we're doing it is very different in that it's hard to explain in a short time, but the basic premise behind promotion is changing radically at Digg so that a topic can really have its own set of criteria that defines it. And a lot of that criteria isn't just going to be Digg's and votes. It's going to be the community itself and friends and social activity. But, you know, you'll see when we reveal, right?
Mm-hmm. Going away from what you're doing now, I'm going to ask you, as you know, Jay Adelson, the father, what's your view on how your children are growing up in this you know, brave new world? I mean, when you and I grew up, you grew up before me, so you were, you know, at the very, very beginning. I grew up where you could have internet connection, but I was still on the command line interface. Like, my first computer was a Commodore 64. What do you think about kids who are born today in a time where all they know is the graphical user interface, and they've always been connected to the internet? Like, a kid nowadays can be 2 years old and has a cell phone. How do you think that your children are going to be different than how you grew up because of that?
Well, it is a different world. Remember earlier I said about getting your car opens up your world? You know, and then with me, because I was extremely nerdy and on the bleeding edge, I had that happen earlier because I was 11 with a computer with a modem. Today it happens to kids when they're 5, because suddenly, you know, you turn your back, and if you don't know what you're doing, they're on YouTube, right? And they could see things that even in the clean version of YouTube would have terrified my parents when I was 11, let alone 5. And as a parent, this is a conundrum to me because, you know, I helped catalyze what has become this place that has really dropped the barrier for children to access information. It can be such a powerful and great tool that could help the world in so many ways. But we as a society aren't prepared for this very rapid transition for children and what it means and how do we guard it and how do we maintain it. We don't have systems that really deal with the maturity required for that and the responsibility required for that. We live in a society that was built around the idea that a child has a parent to govern and watch and provide guidance. And there's a long, let's call it 10 years of learning or maybe 15 years of learning that can exist before we expect someone to make their own decisions in that world. And that's gone. And so what do we do? You know, I think, first of all, the first thing we all have to recognize and embrace is there's a bit of a crisis and there is no magic bullet solution. That there isn't a magic piece of software all going to run or some regulation or something that's going to happen necessarily just in the schools or just in the house that is going to really solve this problem. There's a lot of debate and a lot of discussion going on. We all have to get involved in this debate and discussion. But I think that the first step is recognizing that it's real, recognizing that it's there, and getting involved with your children much, much earlier and explaining and educating them as soon as possible about the risks of privacy on the internet and, frankly, cell phones and all that and what it means. And really doing your best to provide guidance and supervision so that they can make, you know, when the inevitable moment happens, they can make, you know, better decisions. I know in my house, for example, growing up, I had a computer in my bedroom because, God forbid, I had put that thing in the living room. My parents would have probably freaked out with this pale kid sitting there 24 hours a day. But in my house, I have three kids, and the computer sits in the living room. It's part of our lives, just like it's everybody's lives these days, and we use the parental controls built into Apple's Mac OS, and we do our best to be there, sort of the PG, the parental guidance component. And we've set some rules. I mean, Facebook is not going to happen yet with my kids, right? MySpace is not going to happen with my kids. A lot of parents and schools are getting involved at this point to really establish some obvious boundaries there. So I think eventually it's sort of like rated R movies. You know they're going to see them, right? The question is how much resistance you want to create and when, and having the subtleties of knowing when to do these. There's actually a great book, by the way, that I could recommend to your audience. It's called Born Digital. It's the subtitle is Understanding the First Generation of Digital Natives. It's by a guy named John Palfrey. John is just a really bright guy out of Harvard. These guys wrote this book sort of trying to understand what it's like to be a kid in this generation. And it's enlightening. It doesn't necessarily provide solutions. It starts to, you know, but it's more about just the first step we all need to take, which is understanding the reality of the situation.
Okay. Now, just one last question I wanted to ask in particular was, people will say written works have affected them greatly, greatly changed their philosophies on life. Some people will say it was the fountainhead, if you're that type of person. Other people will say it was the Bible or the Bhagavad Gita or the cathedral and the bazaar. What would be one of the written work that's affected you greatly, philosophical, as both an entrepreneur, a technologist, and just in general?
It's a really, really good question. And personally, I've been more inspired, by my experiences culturally around the world and with people and in those interactions than I ever have by a book or by a film. I mean, I will say that when you think about the things that fueled my, if I had to find a book that sort of changed like what I focused on in the world around me and the opportunities, it was actually a fictional book by a guy named William Gibson called Neuromancer, that made me open up my eyes to the power of a virtual world could be. But in terms of my career and what inspired me as an entrepreneur, it really was more about people. You know, sitting on an airplane next to a woman who tells me that she sees a government protest with, you know, 5,000 people show up and are gassed and beaten because they disagree with the political speaker. And the next day, the newspaper says that 5 people showed up and were politely escorted away from the protest. And this is in Colombia. And you recognize that a free press and a democratic media can change that. around the world. You can blog about it, but no one knows your blog is there unless it's exposed. So these are the things, these conversations, these relationships are what inspires me. There is no one novel or book or, you know, anything that really has as much of an impact.
I'd like to say thank you, Jay, very much for being on the show. To my guests, he has been seen also as Time Magazine's Time 100 in 2008, and you can see a lot more of his work at dig.com. Is there any other new projects you would like to promote at the end of the podcast today, Jay?
No, I just, you know, I thank you for having me on. You know, definitely to all your listeners, if you want to check out Dig, it's dig.com. Please feel free to check that out. Check out our dialogues, dig.com/dialogue. That's with two G's. The interviews we're doing with people and newsmakers with questions given by the users and voted on by the users. And then, of course, I have to plug revision3.com, that project that Kevin and I started, which is going strong. It's great geek and tech programming for, you know, I think a new generation of consumers out there. Check it out, find something you like, and tell us what you want.
Thanks a lot, Jay, for being on the show.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Bye-bye.